And tonight on Extension 720, a second visit with Bob Schieffer, known to all the country, undoubtedly, at least anybody with a television set, because you see him every Sunday morning on CBS, hosting Face the Nation. But we see you sometimes on other occasions as well. Was that you last Wednesday night?
That was me.
I thought the moderator of the presidential debate did look familiar.
It was, I must say, Milton, most unusual and interesting experience that I think I have ever had. I've covered some big stories. The assassination of John Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I went to Vietnam. I was there for 9/11. These were three stories that, of all the things I've done, I'll never forget. But I have to add this, moderating this presidential debate, as probably the most interesting and intellectually challenging assignment I ever had. I truly will never forget it.
Were you tense about it?
Yes, I was. And, you know, I've been doing this a long time.
You have indeed.
40 years plus, and I really don't get nervous anymore. Sometimes I get up, but I don't get nervous. Mm-hmm. On this one, I was nervous. I was standing backstage, and it suddenly occurred to me that this could really make a difference in an election this close, that what these men said could actually tip this election one way or the other. And I was a little wobbly in the knees, and then it occurred to me, look, if this is a World Series of politics, you're just the umpire here. Those are the guys that deserve the butterflies. And I thought, boy, if I'm nervous, I wonder how they feel. And I kind of got past it.
Jim Lehrer has done a number of these presidential debates, and he did one this year, of course. Mm-hmm. Do you remember his novel of a few years ago in which he's got the lead person in the novel is a television newsman who's called upon to moderate a presidential debate, and he has it in for one of the two, and he tilts it so as to stick the other.
Yes, I do. You know, Andrea, Jim's a very good friend of mine,
yeah.
And I mean, we really are friends, and we talked several times before these debates. But I remember the novel. Basically, it was something that there was a panel that were going to question
maybe
the president at the time or the candidates.
Jim
at
was
the time.
Here. We discussed it,
and they figured out some way to kind of gang up on him. I can't remember, but it was great. I remember it was a
but
terrific.
They wreck a candidacy by what the newsmen do with the questions they feed.
Exactly.
What are the two candidates?
Yeah.
There is a.
That was not my plan.
Surely it was not. Surely it was not. And you were undoubtedly balanced and calm, and you put up a lot of interesting questions. But of course, what the country was talking about and is still talking about afterwards, quite apart from the performance of the two candidates, was the crucial question that you put about the view on whether homosexuality is a choice.
Yeah.
Did you expect the kind of answer that you got from Kerry?
I didn't know what kind of an answer I was going to get from either one of them on that. But to me, that's the core question. Others mm-hmm. will disagree. But to me, how you come down on that question determines how you feel about all the other things that that come out of that. I thought, if you believe as the president does, I thought he gave as about as good an answer as you can give. He said, Bob, I simply don't know if it's a choice, mm-hmm. but I think we ought to treat all people with dignity and respect. That's a very respectable answer, it seems to me. I thought,
respectable and respectful.
Yes. And I thought that John Kerry gave an almost eloquent answer. He said, and I'll tell you where I come down on it, he said what I believe. He said, I think God made us all, and we don't have much to do with how he made us. He said it in a better way than I have just said it. But I must say that when he put Mary Cheney's name on top of that, it added, whether he meant it or not, it put kind of a harsh, raw edge to it.
He must have meant it, because remember, his partner in the election, Senator Edwards, brought it up also rather gratuitously in the vice presidential debate.
You know, and I thought...
And his opponent winced a bit and said he had no further comment.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of sounded odd when John Edwards brought mm-hmm. it up. But, boy, it really came out of left field, it seemed to me, when John Kerry said it. You know, you have to be, I mean, put all the gay issues aside, you have to be very careful when you start talking about other people's kids. I remember when, you know, I'd go to parents' nights when my mm-hmm. daughters were in school, my wife and I, and if the teacher told us that they were average and they were doing fine, we saw that as a put down. People don't want to hear anything about their kids, but they're the smartest, they're the brightest, and, mm-hmm. you know, like Garrison Keillor's,
sure.
when he describes
all the
like
kids are above average.
All the kids are above average. That's all you want to hear about your kids. I think all politicians should beware of using other people's kids as an example of anything. I just I just kind of wish he hadn't said it. Maybe he didn't mean it that way, but it sure didn't come out.
Did he injure himself thereby?
He may have. He may have. I mean, the thing has sort of taken on a life of its own now. And
of the many columns which view him negatively for having played it that way and view him as having been played it rather cynically, there's a very strong one just today by Sapphire in the Times.
Sapphire had a very strong column. Bob Novak had a very strong column that came to about the same conclusion. And it's, you know, if he didn't mean it that way, he really fouled up what was a very good answer to the question, it seems to me, by putting her name in.
How did the two of them look to you as campaigners, quite apart from their performance when you were in the middle and feeding them the questions? But as the campaign has gone forward over these months now, quite apart from the question of who you want to win, and I'm not going to ask you that, or who you think might win, but how have the two of them comported themselves?
Well, in very different ways. I mean, Kerry is a New Englander, and he does seem a bit standoffish from time to time. That's why I think he really helped himself during the debate when he kind of poked some fun at himself for marrying one of the richest women in the world. I laughed out loud when he said it. And I think any time a politician makes a little fun of himself, it probably helps him. Bush relates to crowds. He's a good campaigner. You know, his dad was not a very good politician, didn't have very good political instincts. He was a very fine public servant, I thought. George Bush has good political instincts, and he talks in ways that I think people do relate to him out on the stump. I mean, he comes off as just kind of a regular guy, a guy you might want to have a cup of coffee with or tell some stories with. And I think that comes through on the stump much more so than it comes through on television. I don't know if he gets stage fright or quite what it is on television, but he comes off better in person, is my
observation. I thought he came off quite well and as a good human being in the second and third. There is a mystery as to why he flubbed the first debate as much as he did.
I'm not sure he was ready for it, or maybe I don't know. I don't know, but I agree with you. I thought he got better in the second debate, and I thought he was about as good as he gets in the third debate.
Are the debates in a closer race, in a close race like this one, really determinative? Will they make the difference?
I don't know what to think about that question. I think John Kerry got himself back in the ball game. I don't think there's any question about that with that first debate. I think his campaign was just about to go over a cliff. Suddenly, people knew who he was, and he didn't turn out to be the cartoon that the Bush administration had painted him to be. I think it was very decisive for John Kerry. I mean, he made it a campaign after that first debate. But I'm not sure people always vote for the best debater. I mean, I was thinking back on this. You know, Adlai Stevenson was quite a good debater, and he was very witty and clever. But people voted for Eisenhower, who probably was not a very good debater. I've never heard of him having a debate, but he was not a particularly articulate man. But people saw him as a man of principle and saw leadership.
What really is very worrisome right now, quite apart from whether the candidate you favor would lose, which worries a lot of people, it being a close race. But what is otherwise very worrisome is whether we're going to get a clean result on the night of November 2nd or whether we're going into another one of those agonizing post-election confusions.
You know, this is what my nightmare is, and it really does concern me. I mean, I'm kind of to the point, I think both of these men are qualified. I think both of them could be president. I think the country would probably be in good hands with either of them. But if we go through another of these things like we did in 2000, it's going to be very difficult. The thing that worries me is this thing going on out in Colorado where they're going to vote on whether to divide up the electoral votes. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if that's what the people of Colorado want to do, fine. But the way this initiative or whatever it is written, it would take effect on this election. Well, how can you have a law that's retroactive? I've never heard of that. It's sure to be challenged in the Supreme Court if in fact, it passes and those votes are crucial. I would have no problem with it if it went into effect 4 years from now, whatever the people of Colorado decide. That worries me. They're already beginning to file challenges in Florida. We may have, and I had Tad Devine, who's one of Kerry's senior advisors, I had him on Face the Nation Sunday, and he says he thinks there's a possibility it won't be decided on election night.
The other thing that worries me, I did a program with John Fund of the Wall Street Journal mm-hmm. only last week.
Yes.
You know his new book, Stealing
yeah.
Elections.
Yes.
And as John reviews it all, it's utter chaos out there. Some of the states are very, very disorganized as to how they count, with tremendous opportunities for actual theft, for mm-hmm. actual falsification, and with a quite real possibility that many people who aren't citizens will be allowed to vote. John starts his book. Have you had a chance to look at it yet?
I know of it. I haven't read it.
He starts his book, the very first paragraph, with a stunning fact of the hijackers of 9/11. Eight of them were registered to vote in this country, though none of them, of course, were citizens.
Yeah.
But motor voter law, since they had applied for licenses in both Maryland and Florida or Virginia, I forget. They, by virtue of motor voter, they were all on the rolls. Of course, motor voter requires that if you're not a citizen, you're supposed to tell somebody you're not a citizen.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't say anything about it, they'll assume you are a citizen, and they'll give you voter registration.
That is absolutely amazing. But
it's utterly corrupting.
You point out something that it's really of concern. I mean, the whole system. There have always been holes in it. Yeah, I mean, back from the time when Lyndon Johnson won his Senate mm-hmm. seat in 1948, and they didn't find those 87 ballots after the election.
That was back in your home territory.
That's exactly right.
Were you already active as a journalist? No, not quite then.
No, but Lyndon Johnson's the first politician I ever saw. I was 10 years old when he came to Fort Worth, and he came in a helicopter. And the reason we all went down to see him, he came to the vacant lot where we mm-hmm. played baseball. And the reason we went to see him is because we heard he was coming in a helicopter, and we'd never seen one.
I remember you write about that in your book of a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
We're going to turn to your book of this year, Face the Nation, My Favorite Stories from the First 50 Years of the Award-Winning News Broadcast. Bob, you've been the host of Face the Nation since 1991?
91. Some people think I've been there the whole 50 years, but that, in fact,
we've also got
true.
Some clips from 50 years of that broadcast, which we're going to be playing, and we'll proceed with all of that right after this. And we return to Bob Schieffer of CBS News, the Washington bureau chief, and, of course, the host, the moderator, on Sunday mornings of their program Face the Nation, which is this year celebrating its 50th anniversary. I hold in my hand a report from the Center for Media and Public Affairs, CMPA, a well-respected outfit based at George Mason University near Washington. And they, this is a few months old, it goes back to, it's dated September 9, but they're already looking at the way in which the networks are handling the news about the election. And their basic conclusion is the broadcast TV networks and weekly news magazines favor John Kerry over George W. Bush, according to the report released today by the Center for Media and Public Affairs. The study also finds that Fox News Channel was far more negative towards Kerry than Bush. These results come from a 2004 Election News Watch project, and they give you something about the methodology. And then major findings. Evaluations of John Kerry were positive by 2-to-1 margin, while evaluations of George W. Bush were over 70% negative. Among nonpartisan sources, Kerry's evaluations were almost 3-to-1 positive. Bush's were over 2-to-1 negative. Among the networks, the gap between the candidates was largest on NBC. The coverage was most balanced on ABC. Obviously, CBS is in the middle. In general, there has been a perception, and apparently from studies like this, it's not totally incorrect, that there is a good deal of bias in favor of the left position on the range of American politics, and in this election, bias in the favor of Kerry, the Democratic candidate. In that context comes the great brouhaha, the affair at CBS, your network, concerning those memorandums, or memoranda, if one wants to be classical, supposedly from the Air National Guard way back at the time of the Vietnam War, demonstrating that his officers thought rather poorly of Lieutenant Bush, until it was, and we know that your colleague went on the air with this, Dan Rather went on the air with it, and thought this was definitive, and even when it was turned up that these were obviously falsified documents, that they could not have been typed on typewriters of that period, but rather were done on word processors that weren't available at that time, back in the early 1960s, Rather refused to acknowledge that. He said, well, we have to look into it further, but he still insisted these were true documents. A great embarrassment for CBS, a great embarrassment for Dan Rather, a man I've met a few times who's been on this program and whom I've always enjoyed, even though he's more lit to the left than I am. I have to define myself in relation to these matters as well. But that was a terrible black eye, it seems to me, for your network, wasn't it?
I think it absolutely was.
Well, what went
wrong? I would also add that Dan has since acknowledged that the report was wrong. He has apologized. CBS has appointed two very distinguished people, former Attorney General Richard Thornburgh and the former head of the AP, Lou Bacardi, to investigate this thing and tell us what we did. And let me just tell you where I am on this, Mel. I don't know what happened here. I know something bad happened. I think we made a very bad mistake.
I think wistfulness on his part clouded perception so that he, even when the evidence came in that these were fake, he couldn't really acknowledge it because he wanted to believe that they were true.
We'll find out, because these investigators have promised to give us, and it's a bark-off investigation. I tell you, they're calling people in. They're conducting this thing like a congressional hearing. It's being done in private. At the end of this, they're going to give us a report. Number one, we're going to make that report public, and so we'll all know exactly what happened. And after that, our bosses, the people at Viacom, Les Moonves, who heads Viacom, they'll decide what action needs to be taken. I want to tell you, it's not going to be some slap on the wrist. This can't be. This is a very serious matter. All of us recognize that it is.
I gather what you're implying is that some heads will roll.
I think it's going to have to.
But more than firing some people, you need to
we've got to do more
get the
than
procedures
that.
Organized.
We've got to do more than that. We've got to put some new procedures in place, and we've also got to do some positive things. It's going to be tough. There are going to be some very tough decisions that are going to have to be made. I don't know what those decisions are because I don't know exactly what happened. When I see this report, if the people who are going to make those decisions don't call me, I may call them because I may have some ideas about it. I mean, all of us who work at CBS News feel hurt by all of this. We want to get this thing back on track. I assure you that once we figure out what has happened, they will take appropriate action. Emil, we don't have any choice. Credibility is our coin of the realm. If people don't believe what we say, then we're going to cease to be. So we're going to get it back on track. In the meantime, we've just got to not make excuses, but take it one day at a time, try to get it back one day and one story at a time to get this thing back to where it ought to be, and just simply take our lumps, because we're due some lumps here.
How's Rather taking it at the moment?
Well, I think under the circumstances, he's doing about as well as could be expected, but he, too, is very concerned. I think he'd probably like to know what went wrong here. I mean, obviously, somebody lied to him.
Yeah, but he let his guard down.
And maybe he did. I don't know. As I say, I don't know what happened here. All I know is that a bad mistake was made, and it simply has to be corrected. And it has to be corrected not by just patting somebody on the wrist, but in a significant way so people know that we're determined to get this back to where it ought to be. It might get kind of ugly here, but it's going to be done because we have no choice.
That report, I would presume, won't be out until after the election.
That's right. And you know, in a way, I'm just as glad. I mean, just why throw one other thing to divert people from this election?
Yeah.
I just think it's better that it come out after the election. We can wait that long.
Let us now turn to happier things,
namely
to this new book of yours, Face the Nation, and subtitled My Favorite Stories from the First 50 Years of the Award-Winning News Broadcast. It's great fun to read this one.
Well, thank you very much. And, I mean, doing this book, I wrote this for one reason. It was just kind of a labor of love. I love this little broadcast, you know. It really is a national treasure. Anything that can last in this world of broadcasting for 50 years has got to be something special. And I sort of sometimes feel like I'm a curator that's been put in charge of this national treasure. And it's my job to kind of protect it and keep it like it is, because Sunday mornings, and not just Face the Nation, but Meet the Press as well. These are different than the talking heads you see at other times.
Meet the Press and Face the Nation have essentially the same format.
Absolutely.
Your other competitor is the one that
the ABC
on
show.
ABC, now run by Stephanopoulos, which has a different way of structuring
it. It's a little different, a little more graphics, a little more modern.
It was at its peak when Dave Brinkley was chairing it.
I think that's probably right. But George is a smart guy, and he's a responsible guy.
But their numbers are way lower still, aren't they?
They go about it in a different way than we do. We're kind of a solid second. Tim is first. He's an hour. We're a half hour. If I could ever get that other half hour, I think I could compete with him. Tim and I are also very good friends. I mean, we're fierce competitors, but it's just like being on two opposing ball clubs. You respect the good players on the other team, and I have great respect for Tim. And I must say, he paid me a great compliment once. Someone asked him, said, when Meet the Press is preempted, what do you watch on Sunday morning? And he said, Face the Nation.
Sure.
Well, I'm the same. I watch his broadcast when I can. We watch each other.
You're in competition for which important figure in this week's news is going to come on which program.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's a competition between the free programs, actually.
Well, actually, there are five of them, because Fox runs a pretty decent program on Sunday morning with Chris Wallace now.
Uh-huh.
And old Wolf Blitzer is right in there. Wolf is the hardest working man on television, cable or network. And so he's in there fighting for those guests, too.
I was amused to learn that on one particular Sunday, that fellow, what's his name? You'll remember, I don't. Monica Lewinsky's lawyer.
Yeah, Bill Ginsburg.
Bill Ginsburg appeared on all five programs.
First person ever to do so, and it became known as a full Ginsburg.
Yes.
Now, John Edwards did a full Ginsburg here 2 weeks ago, and he's one of the few people since Ginsburg who actually has been on all five on the same Sunday.
You came on, we noted a moment ago, in 91. Who preceded you? Who was the first moderator?
The first moderator was the Washington bureau chief at the time. It was a guy named Chet Coop. He handed it off, and he was the broadcaster. He was more of a manager, and after about a year, he handed it off to a guy named Stuart Novins, who then handed it off to a guy named Paul Nevin, I believe it was, and then he handed it off to Howard K. Smith, and then along came Martin Agronsky, George Herman, who did the show for 15 years, and then Leslie Stahl, who preceded me.
We're going to be listening to some clips. And we're going to do the first one right now. This comes in chronological order. So the earliest one we have, well, I should make clear.
It's the first broadcast.
Yeah, this is from a DVD that is issued together with your book. You buy the book, and tucked in the back is a DVD. Is it
2 hours of the excerpts from the most memorable broadcast? The first one, November 7th, 1954. The guest was Joe McCarthy, and he's what you'd call a big get these days, because he came on the Sunday before the Senate took up the resolution to censure him.
Took it up or voted to censure him?
Well, they took about 2 weeks to vote on it, but they began debate on it.
The very next day?
The next day.
And he knew that he was in trouble?
Oh, absolutely. That's why he came on.
Now, who's talking with him here?
That would be Ted Koop, and then Bill Lawrence of the New York Times, and Bill Hines of the Washington Star.
They're the other reporters, interrogators.
Yeah. Yeah.
The form goes way back to those days.
Yeah.
That is, you'd have the basic moderator who continues across the broadcast and a second and or sometimes a third journalist.
Now we sometimes add a second questioner or I just do it by myself. But in those days, you had two.
So here's Joe McCarthy sweating just a bit, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
On the very first broadcast of Face the Nation.
Senator McCarthy, several weeks ago, you predicted that the United States Senate would censor you, and several days ago, Roy Kuhn told us in Indianapolis that the cards were stacked against you. How do you feel about that now, and if you feel the same way, why, Senator?
The Democrats, I believe, will go pretty much down the line on this, and the so-called liberal, I put liberal in quote, Republicans will go along with them. I think they've got plenty of votes to do it. In fact, I was talking to one of my Democrat friends the other day. He told me very frankly he was going to vote for censure. He said, not because of the silly reasons given by the Watkins Committee. He said, but because you labeled the Democrat Party as the party of communism.
You issued an open invitation during the Army McCarthy hearings for people to continue to supply you with information.
That's right.
Regardless of its stamping. Are you getting new information from people in this administration
basis? Let me change your question a bit. I invited them to give information of wrongdoing, graft, corruption, communism. I am continuing to get that information.
Getting documents, too?
Yes.
Are you getting any more as a result of your appeals than you got beforehand? Has there been a flow build up as a result of that?
It's pretty hard to say whether it has increased or decreased. I've been so busy being investigated and preparing for this Lynch be starting tomorrow that I haven't had an opportunity.
You call a meeting of the United States Senate a Lynch be?
Well, let's call it the censure.
No, but I'm interested in this because the Senate's an institution of government. It's part of the Congress.
Let's answer, Bill.
Let's do.
There are a great number of the Democrats who have indicated in private conversations that they will censure McCarthy, not because of what is in the Watkins report, because of I've labeled them as the party of communism, even though I have always pointed out that there are millions of Democrats who are good, loyal Americans, and many office holders here in Washington who are anti-communist. But there are those who feel that they should censure me, not because I cross-examined Zwicker trying to find out about a communist whom he promoted, honorably discharged. There are some Republicans who feel likewise. Now, I consider that, yes, that's a lynching bee.
Well, this is an orderly assembly.
When they're not basing their vote upon the count set forth, when they base their vote upon political reasons, when they say ahead of time, in effect, regardless of what the evidence says, this man has been fighting communism. He's been showing that over 20 years, the Democrat Party has been infiltrated. Therefore, we're going to get him.
Well, now, Senator,
I think a lynching bee is a good name for it, Bill.
Senator,
that is fascinating material.
And you will not be surprised to know that after he came on the broadcast and called the Senate a lynching bee, that senators were just furious. McCarthy clearly came on Face the Nation that Sunday, as many people do, hoping to go over the head of his accusers and go directly to the American people. But he didn't help himself. He dug himself a much deeper hole, and because of what he said on Face the Nation, they really speeded up the censure debate and censured him much quicker than they probably would have.
Those reporters who were questioning him, there are two or three guys out there, is that
right?
Backing off. They are pursuing him and pushing him into the corner.
Yeah, one of them was Bill Lawrence of the New York Times.
I remember Lawrence.
And he later went to work for ABC, remember?
Yeah.
And then Bill Hines, who was one of the best. Bill Hines was still working in Washington when I came there in 1969. Mm. And there was a third voice there, Jep Kadu. And he was in Indianapolis. And one of the most, today, humorous parts of this was, in order to make it look like it was not just inside the Beltway, the moderator, Ted Koop, announced that Jep Kadu of United Press International was 800 miles away in Indianapolis with a question of interest to the Middle West.
Uh-huh.
And that later, when the program was reviewed by a Variety, they seemed more impressed with the fact that you had one of the reporters 800 miles away than they were with what happened on the program.
This is McCarthy almost at the end of his tether. As I remember the Senate does censure him. Which is really just a resolution saying we disapprove of what you did. There's no real punishment, but it brings humiliation upon him. And he starts hitting the bottle heavier than he had done, and it's only about a year or two.
2 years.
2 years
later.
And he expires.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
with cirrhosis of the liver, as I remember.
Yeah, it was the last stop for McCarthy.
Yeah.
Murrah had done the famous documentary on him early in the year.
Also CBS.
And then there had been the Army McCarthy hearings, where people really saw him for what he was.
At long last,
during
Senator,
these long,
have you no shame?
At long last, that was Welch, the Army's general counsel. Those hearings, by the way, were broadcast only on ABC.
Mm.
For some reason, CBS chose not to broadcast them. And then this. The Republicans had lost the Senate. And so the Democrats took control, and that was really the last of Joe McCarthy.
But what do you make of this? He was a bully. He overplayed his hand in many ways. He made claims that just weren't true, like waving the paper with varying number of
names. We never found
names,
a communist.
Communist in the State Department. But later on, sort of a revisionist treatment of all of it, Bill Buckley did a major book in which he said there was a great deal of merit to what McCarthy had to say, even though he played it he hammed it up and he messed up his communication by being personally rather unpleasant. More recently, Ann Coulter has done a very similar book, saying that basically McCarthy was on the right track.
Well, I'm going to let Ann Coulter argue that side of the case. I think McCarthy was a demagogue who brought great harm to this country and ruined people's lives and ruined careers. I think he was just what he appeared in that, and that is just a bully. You know, one of the interesting things about this is that while he probably lost most of his power after that broadcast, a year later when Face the Nation marked its first anniversary, Who but Joe McCarthy sent him a letter of congratulations, and CBS put out a press release saying he had offered congratulations on their first anniversary. Just an amazing thing.
We are predictably running very late for commercials because this is too fascinating. But we'll pause for some of those, then directly back to Bob Schieffer, chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, and, of course, anchor of Face the Nation every Sunday, and the author of the new book, Face the Nation. And we have more clips to play and talk about as well, all to proceed after this. And we return to Bob Schieffer of CBS News. I offer you two quotations, both of them from people who have done political broadcasting on television. For the moment, I won't identify them. The first is, the one function TV news performs very well is that when there is no news, we give it to you with the same emphasis as if there were. And this is from somebody that you know or used to know.
Was it me? Did I say that?
No, not you. The second is, television enables you to be entertained in your home by people you wouldn't have in your home.
Who said it?
That last one is David Frost.
No kidding.
Who, to be sure, did many things on television, but he also interviewed, you remember, he did the interview with Nixon after Nixon's resignation.
Absolutely.
They gave me a sword. I gave them a sword, and they twisted it, or something, the famous Nixon line. Mm-hmm. The first is by a man I know that you knew and undoubtedly must have respected. He used to anchor one of the three Sunday morning broadcasts.
And who would that be?
Prinkley.
I'll be darned. Well, he's one of my heroes.
And he was always a little bit cynical about the business.
Yeah, he was. But he was very, very smart.
I always enjoyed having him. He was on this program three or four times.
And, you know, he's the best writer.
Wonderful.
I always say that David Brinkley also made broadcasting possible for those of us with regional accents. Before David came along, everybody talked like a radio announcer of the old dance band school. And David talked like regular folks.
His book about Washington and World War II.
It was a wonderful book, wasn't it?
A superb book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's just a fine writer. He could write exactly as he spoke. Mm-hmm. He could read from a script or just sit here, you and I, ad-libbing, or just talk to you riding down the street in a car. You couldn't tell if he was reading from a script or if it's just David talking.
He visited us a number of times. Mm-hmm. I just loved having him.
Yeah.
Another clip from, I'm playing games tonight. Mm-hmm. Let's not identify this man. We'll ask our audience to guess who this might be. But this is from a broadcast of, 6257.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll hear a bit of it.
And now, the moderator of Face the Nation from CBS News and Public Affairs, Stuart Novin.
For the past eight centuries, the Kremlin has been the seat of power here in Russia. The word Kremlin means fortress. And inside these walls, decisions have been made which have shaped the history of Russia and influenced the history of the world. Today, such decisions are still being made here in this building. This is the office of Nikita Khrushchev.
Mr. Khrushchev, you have spoken about what you call a healthy attitude of competition among the peoples of both our countries. I would like to ask you, sir, in terms of the international relations between the USSR and the United States, particularly as they refer to conditions in Western Europe and in other parts of the world, what do you consider at this time to be the most pressing points that must be solved between the two countries?
I believe that the main thing is to normalize relations between our countries, between all the countries of the world, and first and foremost, between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Now, what that was probably the most important broadcast that Face the Nation ever did. It was the first interview on television of a ranking Soviet leader. You were hearing the voice of the translator.
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I thought we would hear Khrushchev.
That was Nikita Khrushchev.
That voice would have been Alexei Troyanovsky,
yeah,
who was his regular translator, and later on became the Soviet ambassador to the United Nations.
And I did not know that, but it was a remarkable broadcast. And Khrushchev had not really been seen even by the people in his own country, except in some of those waving from the top of the Kremlin pictures, and it was the first time the American people had ever seen a Soviet leader unfiltered. The amazing thing was, and CBS got accolades from all over the world for this, what was truly a scoop, but the Eisenhower administration was furious about it. Eisenhower at a news conference accused CBS of trying to hike the ratings which really hurt the feelings of Bill Paley, who was the founder of CBS and thought Eisenhower was a friend. He had worked for Eisenhower during World War II in the London censorship office. Ike said he just didn't approve, you know, of having a communist on America, and said, I just won't say whether that's proper or not. His Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, was even more acid. He'd been away duck hunting. He had a private preserve called Duck Island, and they asked him if he'd seen the broadcast. He said, on Duck Island, we have more important things to do than watch a communist. Mm-hmm. It was just amazing. The next day in Congress, two people rose up on the floor, one a Democrat and one a Republican, and introduced a resolution that the next time a communist was interviewed on American television, the questions would have to be cleared in advance with the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department. We kind of come a long way since then. But people just didn't know in those days if broadcasters had the same rights. I mean, if a newspaper reporter had done this interview, Mel, he would have been put in the paper and you'd gone on to other things. But because television was regulated by the government, there was this great hue and cry that we didn't really have the same rights.
Many years later, a virtual star on American television was Gorbachev when he was still
Absolutely.
Prime Minister of the Soviet
what
Union.
They did, the Fund for the Republic, which was a group that had all the blue ribbon citizens of America practically on it, commissioned a study. And they concluded what was important about this broadcast was that it showed if broadcasters were to have the same rights, if they were to, you know, be a true news gathering organization, they had to have the same rights as their print brothers. And from that day forward, they pretty much did. It was a turning point in broadcasting.
Serious and potentially critical question.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy watching these broadcasts. Usually I watch all three of them if I can, if I'm up and around at the right time on Sunday morning. But could not the case be made that what you get from these people, whether they're senators or foreign dignitaries or campaign operatives or what have you, or cabinet officers who often show up, that what you get is boilerplate? That whatever questions you feed them, first of all, they've already been rehearsed. They've worked it up for themselves, or they got assistants who've maybe even run them through a trial run, imagining what you might ask or what somebody else might ask on another one of those programs. And though it's useful and interesting always to see these encounters, these guys are prepared for it, and they very rarely give anything away. The way, to be sure, McCarthy did give a good deal away on that first broadcast.
I think it's a valid criticism, and I'm not sure what you do about it. Everybody has become more and more sophisticated in how to deal with the media. When I came to Washington in 1969, most congressmen did not even have press secretaries. But now everybody has a media coach and talking points and all of this stuff. And I'll tell you, sometimes sitting here, I get so frustrated, I want to jump up and choke them. Well, obviously you can't do that. But, you know, I think our viewers are very sophisticated, and they recognize a non-answer. That becomes an answer. And I think it hurts these people. I mean, I know what the vogue is now in public relations advice is stay on message, don't ever get off message. But I tell you the other thing, I find the politicians that seem to relate best to the public are those who at least give the impression that they're trying to answer the question.
Which ones are those?
Well, John McCain. John McCain would be the first name that comes to mind. The reason John McCain, and I, you know, I often talk and give talks, and I was talking to a group of Republican senators one day, and they said to me, why is John McCain so popular with you guys? And I said, I'll tell you why. You can always find him. I said, most of the politicians we deal with, they're easy to find when they have good news about themselves. But when the news is bad, you can't find them. You can always find John McCain. And reporters like him for that. And as a result, I think he has the best press relations of anybody in Washington. Look how he ran in 2000 when he ran for president, the Straight Talk Express. I mean, he was talking nonstop. Anytime you wanted to talk to John McCain, you could talk to him about anything. And you know, he didn't have enough money to really compete. He had to win every primary against George Bush. But George Bush had so much money, he really didn't have a chance. But he ran a heck of a campaign on a shoestring just because he answered questions.
Somebody else who, at least on one occasion, maybe on more than one occasion, seemed to be speaking from the heart and even in a sort of an unpolitic way was the then Secretary of State, George Shultz.
Yeah. One of the most interesting broadcasts that we ever had on Face the Nation. Leslie Stahl, who was the first moderator of a female moderator on Face the Nation, and she was one tough cookie, I'm here to tell you. And she put George Shultz through the ringer one Sunday morning, and in the end, George Shultz, being on that broadcast, managed to change policy that he couldn't change behind the scenes arguing at the
White
House.
This was on the Iran-Contra.
It was on Iran-Contra.
We have to listen to that clip. We've got some commercials coming, so we won't do it right now.
Okay.
But we'll do it when we return after those commercials.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a very interesting clip indeed. As he was an interesting man, you know where he, what he was doing before he went to government.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
What?
He worked for, was it, not Halliburton, but...
No, that was after he...
Well, he was an economics professor, among other
things. At the University of Chicago.
At the University
of
Chicago.
He was dean of the graduate school.
Yeah.
When I arrived at the University of Chicago as a young professor, he was dean of the Graduate School of Business.
Yeah, well, that's right. I didn't know
him
that far back.
And he's called to Washington, I'm not quite sure when. I guess by Nixon.
Well, he was the secretary of, he was the director
was first,
of OMB
first
for Nixon.
OMB,
and then secretary of Labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had most of the jobs in government.
I guess it was about 68 or 69 that he went to Washington from the University of Chicago to be a director of OMB.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
They're still very proud of that fact.
Absolutely. He's a good man, as we'll see in this clip.
And we'll hear that clip after we pause for these words. And we return to Bob Schieffer of CBS News. We're drawing from his new book, Face the Nation, subtitled My Favorite Stories from the First 50 Years of the Award-Winning News Broadcast. Simon & Schuster, the publishers, I should attest that there are indeed fascinating stories throughout this book, and we are not reviewing most of them, but it's great fun to read, and it's edifying in its own way, to be sure. But we want now to invite telephone calls. We'll be on to the phones, I trust, in about 15 minutes. If you want to get in there early, feel free to do so. Call us at 591-7200. 591-7200 for questions, or for that matter, memories about Face the Nation, for general political queries about what's happening right now and what it all means, and for that matter, more biographical material about Bob Schieffer, who's a very interesting guy. But we're talking not so much about you, but rather about this broadcast and about what's happened, what's passed through the studios of Face the Nation.
And what we've been playing, these clips that we've been playing tonight, are part of the DVD that, of course, is included with this book, 2 hours of these clips, and there are pictures that go with them of the memorable broadcast. To me, it turned out to be the most fun part of this book.
I have not yet even looked at the DVD. Our producer, Maggie Berndt, worked it over this afternoon. She says it's a very, very interesting viewing, of course, and she made these selections. Now, we come back to the one we talked about before, George Shultz, and he's being interviewed by Leslie Stahl. But give us the setting for this.
Well, what was going on, we just had this Iran-Contra mess, and Ronald Reagan had been accused of doing what he said he would never do, and that is trade arms for hostages.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan himself never believed that he had actually done that, but he agreed that a mistake had been made. Leslie was pressing George Shultz, who said, we do not have a policy of trading arms for hostages. And she said, well, then why are you trading arms for hostages? And then this this exchange ensued.
If you tell our allies and other diplomats that our policy remains to embargo arms against Iran, aren't they just going to smile and laugh and say, come on, you're doing it, we're going to do it?
Probably they will. On the other hand, we have to be serious about it ourselves, and we have to reinforce it, and we have to point out to them the reason why we have that policy. And the reason why we have it applies to them as well. They have a stake in a changed Iran. They have a stake in an end of the war. They have a stake in a change in terror, and so on. So I think the basic policies of probing Iran, but at the same time, being tough about an arms embargo, and being tough on terrorism, and not trading arms for hostages. The president said that that was not his intent, and he did not do that. And I think it is clearly wrong to trade arms for hostages. So that is our policy. That remains our policy. And I might say that all of the public discussion has probably helped somewhat, because it has kind of confirmed the fact that, cruel as it may seem to the families involved, and we all can feel that, Still, it isn't the right thing for governments to trade arms or anything else for hostages just because it encouraged taking more.
Will there be any more arms shipments to Iran, either directly by our government or through any third parties?
It's certainly against our policy.
That's not an answer.
I think the signal has been given.
Well, sir, it was against our policy before, and we went ahead and did it. You seem to be saying there will be.
We gave a signal, and the signal has been given, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't see any need for further signals.
Well, then why don't you answer the question directly? I'll ask it again. Will there be any more arms shipments to Iran, either directly by the United States or through any third parties?
Under the circumstances of Iran's war with Iraq, its pursuit of terrorism, its association with those holding our hostages, I would certainly say, as far as I'm concerned, no.
Do you have the authority to speak for the entire administration?
No.
Here you have the Secretary of State saying he does not speak for the administration on foreign policy. George Shultz had been fighting this fight behind the scenes. The next day, the White House put out a statement and said there would be no arms shipments to Iran. And yes, George Shultz spoke for the administration on foreign policy. George Shultz, being pressed by Leslie Stahl, was able to change a policy on the air that he was unable to change within the councils of the government. But that policy stuck.
But one has the suspicion that he made clear to the administration, that is to the president or whoever had Reagan's ear, that he was going to do this when he came on with Stahl, and that if the policy didn't change after he publicly disavowed the policy, he would resign.
I think that was implicit.
That was
what
you were
saying.
That change.
But George Shultz was a tough guy. He was a very tough guy. He was also a very smart guy. And, you know, he went up and testified before that congressional committee on Iran-Contra. He didn't bring a lawyer with him. He didn't even bring any notes. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't need them. He sat down there, folded his hands, and said, I'm going to answer every question until you don't have any more questions. He was a stand-up guy, and he was willing to be held accountable, and nobody was going to push him around. I mean, I have great admiration for George Shultz. He's one of the toughest guys I ever tried to cover, because he didn't watch television or pay much attention to it. That wasn't good for the guy covering the State Department, which what I was at that time.
Apparently, secretaries of state don't watch television.
Yeah, sometimes they don't.
You said Dulles didn't, and now you're telling me that Shultz didn't.
But wasn't that just extraordinary to watch him say that?
Yeah, fascinating confrontation.
Yeah, it really was.
You just wonder if it was rehearsed.
No, it wasn't
rehearsed.
It was one of those moments that every once in a while you break through the talking points, you break through the media training, and you kind of get to the truth, and that it's all worthwhile.
I wish I had that clip when Leslie Stahl was on this program 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
did a memoir.
Uh-huh.
It
Absolutely.
Great to play that then. We come to your reign at Face the Nation. Your very first go-around was with whom?
Danny Rostenkowski.
Of Chicago.
Chicago, Illinois. And he was always a great interview. Sometimes you didn't agree with Congressman Rostenkowski, but he had a way of putting things that made it interesting to talk to him, and he knew everything there was to know about Capitol Hill. So I always thought he was a great guest. I still talk to him from time to time. He's a great fan of the program, and I must say still watches.
Who else was there in the first year for you? Who stands out in memory?
You know, it's the years are all coming together now. I can't remember, but every person who has served as president has appeared on Face the Nation since Eisenhower. I've interviewed most of them since my first interview was, I guess, with Jimmy Carter. Gerald Ford would have come first, and then Jimmy Carter. Everybody who's run for president since then, I have interviewed.
You interview them as president as well, or only when
I have interviewed Carter and Ford and Clinton as sitting presidents. I've interviewed all the others either before, while they were running.
But in that case, they don't come to the studio, you go to them.
Yeah, when they're president, you generally go to them.
Speaking of presidents and speaking of President Clinton, one of the great stories that you covered, both as bureau chief and, of course, at Face the Nation, was the affair, L'Affaire Lewinsky, and then the impeachment struggle with all the different attendant investigations and so on. What are your general reflections on it?
Well,
we're
my general...
We're going to play some clips on it, but before we do
it
that...
was not a pleasant thing to do. I mean, anytime you cover a story that involves sex, it's going to get tawdry, and this was about sex. And it was also about a president's judgment, it seemed.
It was also about
a
president lying to a grand jury.
And that was not the least of it, was it?
Yeah.
So it was not a pleasant thing when it was over. I mean, everybody was just relieved. I mean, it was not something that anybody really wanted to cover. But, you know, we had to cover it. I mean, because here the movement started to impeach someone, to overturn an election. You got to take that seriously. And so it was taken seriously all down the line, but it was also just kind of an unpleasant thing. I mean, one of the most embarrassing afternoons of my life, it's kind of hilarious to look back on it, was when the Star report came out. And my job was, we had gotten a bootleg copy of the thing, and we did get a scoop. We got on the air with it before everybody else. But I had this chain of producers who were getting it off a congressman's copying machine and bringing it to me one page at a time. And I was trying to sight read this thing to make sure that I didn't say something I shouldn't say on live television. And I find myself at one point reading, and I'm talking to Dan Rather, and I say, "Dan," and then he put his hand up under her sweater, and I remember saying at one point, "Dan, I think we better stop his hand right there while I see what's at the bottom of this page to see where this is going." I've never seen anything like this, you know, and it was, as I say, it was hilarious in retrospect, but it was not so hilarious at
here's
the time.
Here's a program towards the beginning of, well, let's see, when does it all break? This is your program from February 7th.
Well, this was early on. You're talking about the Bob Bennett?
Yeah, this is early. This is Senator Robert Bennett and Senator John Breaux and Patrick Leahy.
This is some of the large groups we'd assembled for Face the Nation. We had defenders and those who were critics of the president. And it would get pretty heated from time to time in the studio because this was not one where people came down in the middle. You either felt strongly one way or strongly the other. But this is one of those times.
Let's hear it.
Do you have a feeling that in the Republican caucus that there are senators who want to vote for censure, or is it just something that they want nothing to do
with? I have the feeling very strongly that a vast majority of the members of the Senate, regardless of party, regardless of where they are on the ideological spectrum, want to leave some kind of formal statement of indignation and outrage over what this president has done.
I think members want to make sure that we're not saying that he's innocent. And a censure resolution essentially says that what he did was wrong, it brought embarrassment on himself, he misled the people, he misled his staff, and that he should be censured as a result of it, and this would do that.
We're going to have to vote on the articles of impeachment, either vote to remove the president or vote to keep him. But I think the thing that unites every single senator is our opposition to the president's conduct. So I think that there will be a strong expression of censure. The president probably will not like what is in it. But that's really immaterial. Well, we didn't like what he did. And so if he doesn't like what we say, that's his problem because we did not like his conduct.
Now, Bill, that was the last person you heard was Democrat Pat Leahy.
Yeah.
Then you heard John Breaux, a Democrat, and you heard Bob Bennett, a Republican. And what they are arguing about is there should be some sort of censure. What happened here is the Republicans in the House were so determined that censure would be used as an excuse not to impeach that they refused to consider the idea of censure. They sent it over to the Senate. It got there. Senators by that time were just so afraid they were going to get it on them, and they wanted to get the thing over with that they first thought about censure, and then in an effort to get it over with, they decided not to censure, and there was no reason. I mean, the votes just weren't there to impeach him. The result was, and I think it's the fault of the Republicans, there was no censure. Bill Clinton walked away clean, I mean, as if he had been found not guilty. And I think in retrospect, a lot of people now wish that there had at least been something on the record taking note of this, some sort of censure. But it didn't come about because Republicans in the House in the beginning were so determined to push impeachment when senators were telling them, we don't have the votes to
We've got two Bob Bennetts. We just heard from Senator Robert Bennett of Republican of Utah.
Yeah.
And then we've got another broadcast. Does this come before or
this
after?
This came before. And I tell you what, this is Bob Bennett, who was the president's lawyer.
Exactly.
Now, let me just set this one
the
up.
The
for
brother,
you.
One might note, of Bill Bennett.
Bill Bennett. It was a strong supporter. Yeah. It was a strong Republican. The deal was, at that point, Paula Jones, who had come before Monica Lewinsky, mm-hmm. had accused the president of sexual harassment while he was a governor. And she claimed that she knew certain things about the president's anatomy that only someone who had been intimate with him could have known, including a certain deformity that she claimed that the president had. Bob Bennett came on the program, and in answer to a question from Gloria Borger, who was on that day, gave the darndest, I'll put it that way, the darndest answer I've ever heard anyone give. And here's how it
went. A striking and startling moment on network television. Here it is.
We heard a report reported today in U.S. News, my magazine, which essentially says that during the president's physical, he was checked out. There are no such, quote, distinguishing characteristics, as Ms. Jones has claimed in an affidavit.
On October 3rd, the president underwent a thorough physical examination. At the press conference following that examination, Dr. Kevin O'Connell was present. And had any member of the press asked him about it, what Dr. O'Connell would have said is that on thorough examination, there is absolutely no unique characteristics of any kind, that in terms of, and this is awful to even have to discuss this, but the plaintiff has forced this on us, in terms of size, shape, direction, whatever the devious mind wants to concoct.
Is that what was in the affidavit?
The president is a normal man. In addition, Gloria, there was a thorough dermatological examination. There are no blemishes. There are no moles. There are no growths. I trust now that we can put this behind us and get on with the issue.
Is that what she claimed in the affidavit?
I'm not going to dignify what's in that, but Dr. O'Connell, thorough examination, adamantly rebuts everything that is in that affidavit.
Would you be willing to make a financial settlement? In other words, give Paula Jones some money if she would drop this lawsuit?
The president is not willing to pay any money out of his own pocket, nor is he willing to ask his friends to pay it.
Is he willing to offer any kind of an apology?
He's not going to apologize to something that did not occur.
And no statement of misconduct.
No statement of misconduct.
It occurs to me, listening to that, that if you could just imagine commentary from the floor of the House, somebody might have spoken of the distinguished member from Arkansas.
Well, what we found out from Bob Bennett, the president's lawyer, was that the president was normal in size, shape, and direction. I mean,
incredible.
I thought
to discuss the president's generative organ on national
television. I thought my jaw was going to hit the table when I heard Bob Bennett, who is a friend of mine, say that. Gloria said later, I just hope my mom wasn't listening. I've never heard anything like that said on television. But again, we talk about talking points and staying on message. Every so often, you never know what somebody's going to say on these broadcasts.
It's also a commentary indirectly upon the man who owned the organ. I mean, he is the only president who put us in that situation.
Well, you know, I asked Bob Bennett afterward. I said, I want to find out, how did you know all this? Was it personal observation? He said, oh, no, no. He said, I got it from his doctor.
He got it from the doctor, yeah.
I knew he did, but I had to kid him a little bit.
Memorable moments from Face the Nation.
I'm telling you.
What's been memorable for you in the last year or so?
Well, I mean, this whole war in Iraq. I mean, we moved when the war in Iraq was going on, where we were actually talking to our reporters live on the battlefield. You know, we called Vietnam the living room war, but those reports were all on film. Hmm. And they were usually at least 2 days old by the time they were shipped by aircraft, back to the United States and edited. What you saw in Iraq was something totally different. This was actually being broadcast at the moment it was happening. It was a new kind of challenge for us. Our guys did some very brave and innovative things, and we always remembered that. Also, 9/11. I mean, to me, 9/11 is the story that it'll be a long time before I forget that one, Milton.
You sat on a building, on the roof of a building quite near
the White House.
The White House.
Yeah. And I was on top of the Chamber of Commerce building, which is right across Lafayette Park. I was headed up to the Capitol after the two airplanes hit the trade towers. And as I was heading up there, my bureau chief, Janet Leister, called me on my car phone and said, where are you? And I said, I'm trying to get through this traffic to get to the Capitol. And she said, get out of there. We think there's another plane headed to Washington. We think this one is headed for the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And You know, that was the one that those pastors in Pennsylvania forced down. Had they not done what they did, I might not be here with you tonight.
One of the people on that plane was on this program only about 3 weeks before.
Really?
Barbara Olson.
Yes, and Barbara was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
I knew she and her husband both. And
she had done a book just shortly before.
Yes. Well, I knew Barbara quite well. She had worked for Don Nichols up on Capitol Hill. And during the hearings up there, she had actually given me a couple of stories. She slipped me a couple of documents, which turned out to be accurate.
She was a very admirable woman.
I liked her very much, yes.
We are going to pause some commercials and then right onto the phone. So now a clear invitation to all who are listening and want to join us to pose a question or offer a thought or comment. Call quickly on 591-7200. 591-7200. The lines are open and available to you. If you're listening on the Internet at some greater distance and would rather reach us by email, the email address is, of course, extension 720 as one word, extension 720 at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200 on to your contributions after this. And my thanks to a listener who called in and said to Maggie Burnt that I was mistaken, as indeed I was, when I said that Barbara Olson was on that plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. No, she was on the plane that crashed into the Pentagon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't catch it when you said it, Milton. Yeah. That's absolutely
I recognize that that's correct. My memory confounded that just a bit. 591-7200 is the number. And we go to the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen, and Mr. Schaefer. It's quite a privilege. I'd like to congratulate you on your job moderating at the last presidential debate. I thought you were the winner. You can't really determine winners there, but you were the best moderator, in my opinion. Thank you very much. One thing that you had said that evening, you had mentioned the problem that we have with illegal immigration over the southwestern border of the United States, and I believe you stated 8,000 per day, which is roughly 3-odd million per year. And nobody seemed to really challenge your numbers. Now, here in Illinois, we had a very interesting primary for the Illinois U.S. Senate competition on the Republican side, where Jim Oberweis, who came in second place and very nearly replaced the dropped-out leader, Jim Ryan, he had stated in one of his ads 10,000 per day or a soldier field a week. And he was, I believe, even by Milton Bosses there at the Tribune, pretty much lambasted in the press for being wrong on his numbers. And I wondered, where did you get your numbers, and what do you think we should do about this, what some are calling the reconquest or la reconquista, and others are saying that the establishment is essentially becoming an amigo of the reconquista?
Well, let me just say first, I don't know what we ought to do about it. Immigration is something that I am not an expert on. The reason I asked that question is I got more email asking me to ask that question than on any other single issue. It's an issue that doesn't come up so much in Washington, but apparently there's a lot of talk about it out through the country. The number, we use the number 8,000. We called several experts, and we got estimates ranging from 5,000 to some experts told us as many as 12,000. And we settled on just kind of a middle figure of 8,000. I mean, I don't think anybody really has an exact count, you know, that or there's any way to get one. But that was generally seemed among the people that we talked to be what they said was a fair number.
Sir, thank you. A valuable first question, and we'll go on to the next on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. Mr. Schaefer, pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I had a question. I just purchased your book recently.
Oh, good.
And I enjoy reading it. And one of the things that really was a lure to me was the DVD.
Uh-huh.
And I truly appreciate that. I teach high school history, so
great.
Something that comes in handy. If, for the lack of a better word, a critique of the DVD, and maybe you could comment on this.
Sure.
It kind of follows up. What was your relationship with President Nixon? And regarding the DVD, why wasn't there a section specifically on Watergate, since it was such a monumental time in your career, let alone the nation's?
Well, there is one. You have Mel Laird talking in there at one point. I have a chapter in the book about the question I should have asked Mel Laird about the Pentagon Papers and didn't. So you can't take a picture of something that you didn't do, and that's the reason we didn't have that. But we do have a cut in there of Richard Nixon when he was campaigning as vice president, campaigning for the presidency. But you're right, you know, there's always something you should have put in more of than you did, and it would have been good to have a little more on Watergate in there. But I must tell you, I had more fun putting the DVD together, and it was not really my idea. I was about halfway through the book when the editor of the book, Rob Weisbach, said, you know, we have the capability to add a DVD to this book, and why don't we do that? And I said, well, that's great. And so I went back, and we went back through some of these old broadcasts, and it was really fun to me. I'll tell you one of the things, you want to know one of the things that I learned most from? I realized how pompous reporters can be asking questions. And as I would watch some of them pose questions in these old broadcasts, I said to myself, remember, just ask straight, short questions, and you'll get the best answers. When you're up there with these long, pompous questions, you generally don't get very good answers. And we saw that time and time again.
An honor to your profession.
Well, you're very kind to say that. I'm one of the few people, I suppose, that is getting to do exactly what he wanted to do when he was a little boy.
And well, we appreciate it.
It's been a great life for me, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir.
And we thank you for the call, sir. And we'll pause in just a moment and try to catch up with the commercial schedule. There are now one or two lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. If you try for the first time and hit the busy signal, don't get totally discouraged, but try again in a few minutes or certainly after we say goodnight to some other caller. 591-7200, the number. We return after this. And here, Bob, is a question that comes via email, which I think is of considerable interest. This caller says, I seem to recall that Mr. Schieffer was a print journalist working for a Fort Worth newspaper on that fateful November day in Dallas 41 years ago. If I'm not mistaken, he had a rather unique encounter with either the mother or the wife of Lee Harvey Oswald. I wonder if he might share a few of his recollections from that tragedy.
You know, I did, and I still look back on this, and some days I wonder, did it really happen? But it really did. I was a police reporter at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. After Kennedy was shot, I was on the city desk, and I was just trying to help field phone calls, and I picked up a phone, and a woman said, is there anybody there who can give me a ride to Dallas? And I said, lady, you know, we don't run a taxi service here, and besides, the president's been shot. And she said, yes, I heard on the radio, I think my son is the one that they have arrested. And it was Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. Another reporter and I went out to the west side of Fort Worth, picked her up, and we drove her to Dallas, and I interviewed her on the way to Dallas. The incredible part of the story is I always, in those days, we never told people who we were. I always dressed so I'd look like a cop. I always wore a snap-brim hat so I'd look like Dick Tracy. We got to the Dallas police station. I said to the first officer I saw, is there anywhere we can put this woman? I'm the one that brought Oswald's mother over from Fort Worth. He said, of course, and we took us into a room. We had our own little private room there. As the evening wore on, she asked if she could see her son, and I went to Captain Will Fritz of the Dallas Police, and he said, I think we can do that. They took us all into a holding room. I'm looking around. Now, mind you, I've been in the police station 3 hours. Nobody has yet asked me who I was. I just look like I belong. Finally, a guy standing there, who I think probably was an FBI agent, said, who are you? And I said, well, who are you? And he said, are you a newspaper man? And I said, well, aren't you? And he said, listen, son, stop being cute. He said, I want you to get out of here, and if I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you. I mean, I think he was serious. He probably wasn't, but I think he was. So that's the biggest story I almost got and didn't. But, I mean, what an adventure in the midst of that tragedy.
Of course, you read about this in your first book.
In my first book.
But what were your impressions of the mother?
Oh, she's crazy. Crazy as a loon, and not just crazy, but mean. On the right way over to Dallas, she began to talk about how everyone would feel sorry for his wife, no one would feel sorry for her, and his wife would get a lot of money, and she wouldn't get any and would starve to death. She was totally obsessed with money. And years later, even after I'd gone to work at CBS, she would sometimes call me and say, do you think they'd pay me to do an interview? She lived out her life basically selling his clothes to souvenir hunters. And she was the real witch of the piece. One hates to speak ill of the dead, but she was just a terrible person.
Back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, Hello, Professor Rosenberg. Good evening, Mr. Schieffer. I wonder if I can ask a question about the Lewinsky affair, even though that's a very tired subject. But I wonder if I can get something...
Tired, but of eternal fascination, I fear.
Probably. Your response to one aspect of early on in the scandal, and that was the initial Jim Lehrer interview with the president that had been pre-scheduled, apparently.
That's the wagging finger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had no concept with that woman. And what struck me about that, and in addition, what struck me was the lack of attention and analysis that went to that interview, and particularly Mr. Lehrer's his approach to the interview, was that he asked the president, you know, about his relationship with Lewinsky in such a way as to assume that we were all entitled to that information, and even though there was no real, I think at that point, allegation that an actual law had been broken, but he essentially forced the president at that moment to come clean about a relationship that had, presumably been, private in nature and hadn't inherently broken any law. And that was what forced, the president to make that statement and forced him to essentially deny the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it isn't an ordinary part of journalistic protocol to sort of filter out or censor out questions that the public isn't necessarily entitled to have an answer for. But it just seemed to be a key moment where Mr. Lehrer assumed that, well, that's information the public is entitled to, and right there he put the president on the spot and forced him essentially in front of millions and millions of people to either affirm or deny that he had had this relationship. I wonder what your response, both in terms of how you reacted to that interview and your sense of its place in the overall scandal and the journalistic protocol aspect of it.
Well, I mean, generally speaking, we always say that a person's private life is his private life until it interferes or sort of intrudes on his public life. The president had held himself out to be a family man, and that had been one of the reasons, when he went through the thing with the other woman during the primaries. He and his wife attested their love for one another. And this kind of challenged that. And, in politics, hypocrisy is a lie. I mean, hypocrisy is a felony. So I think it was a proper question to ask. But I must say, when Jim Lehrer asked it, I always tend in the beginning, I guess, to give the president the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I couldn't imagine that he would have the bad judgment to be doing some of the things that he had been accused of doing. And I think there were questions about his judgment at that point that also made it a legitimate a question to pose.
So you then believe that it was appropriate to ask him that question, and that we were all entitled to know, and that's based on his having claimed to be a family man and that he wasn't an adulterer or philanderer, mm-hmm. and having made those claims and that having been part of his self-presentation as a candidate, that we were entitled to know that. I myself have wondered quite a bit because I personally felt that it was sort of an abuse of his position. I don't think one should engage in
I don't see how. Let me check this with you, Bob. I don't see how, with all that had already been said and had been put before the public, that anybody could avoid, nor could the president avoid, being confronted with that question by somebody.
Oh, I think you had to ask that question because this was something that was going to go on, and it was clear at that point that this was going to, some resolution of this was going to have to be made. So I think Jim Lehrer, who's a very responsible guy, and he's the last person in Washington who's going to try to do something just for sensational reasons, I think it was an appropriate question at that point.
Here's another email referring back to the recent debate. In the debate recently, why did Mr. Schieffer choose, the question for President Bush, which asked to name three mistakes which the president made and what he did to remedy the mistakes?
I didn't ask any such question.
That was in the second debate.
Yes. I asked no such question. That was a question that had come from the audience
and that
in
was
the town hall debate.
What's his name from ABC?
Yeah, Charlie Gibson.
Charlie Gibson. So the listener has that wrong. But still, he does ask, how did Mr. Schieffer, let's say now, how did Mr. Gibson expect Senator Kerry to give a rebuttal? It was an invitation to Senator Kerry to state again all the mistakes which President Bush made. Did Mr. Gibson make a mistake? I was bothered by that coming up at the last minute also.
Yeah, it wasn't my favorite question, and I'm not sure I understood the question either.
Yeah. And you couldn't expect the president to say, well, here are three serious mistakes I made. No one was going to ask the same of Kerry. It was just, it was a really bad judgment by Gibson to have chosen that, I think. 591-7200, the number, as we go to this caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Schieffer. It's an honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say.
I have watched you for many years. I was born in the early 50s, and you are, you're, I think, probably the most distinguished person in news on broadcast.
Well, I don't know about that, but I appreciate you saying it.
Well, and so I have two questions. One is, do you, what is your opinion of, and do you listen to National Public Radio, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered, and what your opinion is of those shows? And also, if you could just say a word about Eric Severide and Howard K. Smith, who are also two very favorite journalists of mine.
Well, Howard K. Smith was a wonderful person, and I kept up with Howard K. Smith all through his life. He just was a real example to all of us. Eric Severide was probably the smartest person I ever met from the standpoint of just all-around smarts. He was a true intellectual. I loved him and respected him. He was a great mentor for me. When I write my commentaries, I try to be Eric Severide, I guess. You know, when I tell young journalists how to learn to be a reporter, I say just copy somebody that whose work you really like, and as you learn how they did it, you'll develop your own style. Both Howard and Eric were two men that I just greatly admired. They were real giants. They had great reputations, and they were very well deserved. Now, there was another part of your question, which was?
National Public Radio.
Oh, National Public Radio, yes. I do listen to All Things Considered. I think it's one of the best news broadcasts on the radio or television, for that matter. And you know, one of the things I really like about it, they don't have a lot of sound effects and bells and whistles, and they speak in a conversational tone that makes it much easier, I think, to understand the news. I not only like the content, I like the way they present it.
Along those lines, what do you feel is right and what is wrong with the evening half-hour network news broadcast?
It's too short. These are digests. There's not enough time.
I quite agree.
To do the longer stories that I think people can remember. Sometimes you have to, you know, to get in a number of stories and feel like you've covered the day's news, you have to devote so little time to each of them that basically all you get is a headline. I think they're good. I watch them, but I recognize they're just a digest. You're not going to get the complete story on them.
Do you think Lehrer's evening broadcast? I don't mean Lehrer. I mean, yes, I do mean Lehrer. Do you think that one works better?
Yeah, I like
That's
it.
That's a pull-out.
I mean, I like it, but I have time to sit down for an hour and watch it. And I think Jim is terrific. And I really like to hear knowledgeable people discuss issues rather than hear them put into story form. And in that way, I think it's quite valuable.
There's an excellent program on BBC, which you can pick up on the Internet regularly, called Newsnight.
Uh-huh.
Do you know it?
I do not.
It's similar to the Lehrer. They do a full hour, and they have three or four major topics, and they bring in people from around the UK as necessary, sometimes people from the US, and they just discuss important matters
intelligently. I mean, one of the things, Milton, I mean, this is just my idea of it, but now with so much news available out there on cable and the Internet, I sometimes wonder in the evening news programs that the networks do, would we be better off doing, say, three stories a night instead of doing 8 or 9,
I don't know.
It's, and I'm not even sure I believe that that's what we ought to do, but I think it's one of the things we might ought to think about.
Right now, I must think about my commercial obligations. We pause for a last quick round and then back to the phones. If you've been trying to reach us, we've now got a number of lines available. 591-7200. If you move quickly, you may well get through. We are back in full form now that the baseball season is over, and I'm going to give you a quick rundown on programs to come. It's a very strong week. We've begun in a very strong way with Bob Schieffer. We'll continue in just a moment. But here's what's coming up beyond that. Tomorrow night, Jerome Kagan is one of the leading representatives of my own scholarly discipline, that is psychology. He's a developmental psychologist, professor at Harvard. He's got a new book titled The Long Shadow of Temperament, and it concerns itself with just what is given and built in, hardwired, so to speak, in character and in reactive emotive style in children and how that continues on into adult life. Wednesday night is our annual night at the opera with the manager of the Lyric Opera, Bill Mason, with Roger Pines, the dramaturge there, and with at least two of the lead singers. One of them, Aaron Wall, and the other, I believe, will be Sir Andrew Davis, the conductor. Thursday, we talk with another eminent scholar from Harvard, this time a great literary scholar, Stephen Greenblatt, whose new book is about how Shakespeare became Shakespeare. It's titled Will in the World. And during that program, we'll have occasion as well to play some clips from some of the great plays. On Friday night, two of the representatives of an organization on whose board I serve and which does very important work, I am convinced, namely the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, Paul Kurtz and Jim Underdown, and we'll debunk some of the magical, mystical stuff that people are roped into believing, though they should know better. 591-7200 is our number as we go back to the phones. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenberg. Another great program. Who needs television when we've got this type of quality?
Well, you
radio.
Need television on Sunday morning to watch Face
well,
the Nation.
That's true. As far as Face the Nation is concerned, my wife and I grew up watching it for the last 50 years, and we stopped watching it because of Mr. Schaefer's bias toward against Colonel Oliver North. We thought he did a horrible job of interviewing him one time. He was very, I thought, rude to him and showed a bias that CBS shows quite constantly. You mentioned Severide and Howard K. Smith. Who can forget Howard K. Smith's interview of Alger Hiss at the time that we had a sitting president who had helped to bring him to justice? And as far as Severide is concerned, he was a bomb thrower as a college student and very radical. In fact, that whole group had been rather worse.
Stop for a minute now.
There's bias there.
And Bob, how do you plead?
I don't think the bias is always with the speaker. Sometimes, and I might just say this gently, it might be with the person out there listening. I'm not sure that I could do much of anything that could please this listener, but I want to tell you something. He has every right to say and feel the way he does.
What happened with Oliver North? It's a program I did.
It was one of the most, I would say, antagonistic kind of interviews. It was, he came on, he had claimed a lot of things. And
this was also at the time of Iran-Contra?
Yes, and he was running, this was after that, and he was running against Chuck Robb for the United States Senate. Uh-huh. He'd made a lot of allegations, and I'd done a little homework, and I called him on most of them, and we had a really go at it. But I'm happy to tell you that Ollie and I get along just fine these days, and I have no problem with him, and I think he's a good American.
Have you appeared on his radio program?
No, I haven't.
We go back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Hey. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm calling about, I have an impression that with all the competition with cable news and all the news outlets that are available, that the broadcast news, especially the big three, have had severe income shortfalls. And my impression is that they've closed a lot of foreign news offices for CBS, NBC, and ABC. And when I listen occasionally to, like, the BBC World Report on television, you really get a sense of what the news of the world is all about. But when I listen to and watch American Network News, it seems like their impression of world news is limited to Pakistan and Iraq.
Well, there's no question that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, and this is kind of it's sort of a historic cycle, when there's no threat from abroad, Americans have generally turned inward, and we saw that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the news agencies sort of followed suit as Americans became more and more interested in things closer to home. You saw the networks focusing on things closer to home. I happen to think that we do have a duty to educate, and I think we have not done enough foreign news. But that's just one of the reasons that that came about. But I think you make a valid criticism.
Well, it's not a criticism as much as it was an observation. Is it true that a lot of foreign news bureaus for CBS have been closed because of budgets?
A lot of foreign bureaus have been closed for all of the networks. One of the reasons for that is technology. We now have satellites. We now have the ability to move pictures from one place to the other, and you don't have to send a cameraman 100 miles down the road to get a picture. You can get it from somebody else and send it back to this country with the speed of light. But there have been severe budget constraints. And for the reason for that is that because you now have 200 choices when you turn on your television rather than three choices, all of our audiences have shrunk. Anytime you divide a pie into 100 slices rather than three slices, you're gonna reduce the size of the audience. There's no way that anybody can hold the kind of audience and the size audience that you once had. You sell television commercials according to how many viewers you have. The more you have, the more you can charge for the commercials. So we have not been able to charge it as much, so there have been budget constraints. But I would just say this. I still believe that the American people have access to more information than any people who've lived on the earth at any one single point. I still think Americans have the best press, and by that I mean newspapers, radio, and television, of any country in the world. And if you'd like to pick out one that you think is better, I'd be happy to hear that. I still think, all in all, we probably have the best.
I agree with you there, and thanks for doing such a good job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your call.
Good night.
Good night, sir. We have only about a minute and a half left. What are you looking forward to for the rest in coming broadcasts and over the next year or two?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing who wins this election.
Sure you are.
This is as close an election. I've never seen anything like it. What I'm so happy about that there are a lot of young people signing up, registering to vote. We could have a very large voter turnout. I hope that we do. I just pray that we know on election night who won. I want this to be decisive. Much more than I care about which one of these candidates win, I just want us to know. I do not want to see another one of these nightmares where we go back to the Supreme Court.
Are the Democrats setting the wrong tone by having recruited a few thousand lawyers and sending them out to contest everything wherever they can?
Well, both parties. Everybody's getting ready. Tad Devine, one of Kerry's top advisors, told us Sunday they're not sure that this is going to be decided. We have this situation out in Colorado where there'll be a question about how the electoral votes are split up. There are many different ways that this could wind up at the Supreme Court again. I just hope to goodness that that doesn't happen, that whoever wins, wins decisively.
What's your assignment on the night of November 2nd?
Oh, I'll be sitting right there at CBS News Election Headquarters reporting it as it happens. We're going to get it right this time. I hope we don't have to take back any calls.
You did have to take it back last time, didn't you?
Oh, we did, but we've redone everything. New software, new procedures, new safeguards. Let's see if we can't get it right this time. We generally have.
Well, I'll be checking on you.
Okay, man.
In between what we do here, I'll be looking at CBS, and probably, I must confess, some of the other networks as well.
Well, that's fair on election night.
Bob Schieffer has been our guest, and it's been a great pleasure for me personally. The new book, Face the Nation, is subtitled My Favorite Stories from the First 50 Years of the Award-Winning News Broadcast. And it's important to say that along with the book comes that two-hour DVD with fascinating clips. And with that, we'll close down for the night.